Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
It might appear rather strange to devote a programme to the House of Lords. After all, I imagine Vladimir Putin lies awake at night wondering about how the changing nature of the House of Lords might affect world politics, etc., etc. Spare the sarcasm, Jeremy. But we have decided to do so because, in terms of the Constitution of Britain, it is a matter that is of some moment at present. And it's a moment, for two particular reasons. The one that is most long-standing is the proposal essentially associated with Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of Britain from 2007 to 2010, that the House of Lords should in some way be used to solve what he sees as the British or federal question. In other words, the issue of whether Scotland should remain part of the United Kingdom, which he feels would be easier to pursue if there was a upper chamber that included separate representation from the constituent parts of the United Kingdom, which is Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England. Separately, there is a sense we can discuss, I will discuss, that Boris Johnson, Prime Minister from 2019 to 2022, has taken the usual process by which Prime Ministers reward their chums and, you know, failed MPs, such like, creeps who've given a lot of money and just avoided the law courts, you know, you can fill in the list, and makes them members of the House of Lords. And whilst this has always been the case, it has been taken to egregious lengths by that, I was about to say the last Prime Minister, but of course he was the one before last, such is time moving fast. So that's the background for our discussion, and I'm going to try and add an historian's perspective on it, without in any way pretending, as so many other historians do, that they in some way arise from bed with Clio, that's the muse of history, and that in some way that they represent the voice of the past. I may be getting old, but I certainly can't claim that prerogative. So let's start with a few points. First of all, on the latter point, yes, Boris Johnson has pushed it to possibly extremes. That does not mean that there have not been good people who have merit and ability who have been made peers as a result of his choices. And I can think off the top of my head of Lord Sharp, Lord Moore, Lord Hannan, Lord Roberts, all of whom by any and every standard exemplify everything that is best in the traditions of the House of Lords. And I'm sure there are others. It has to be said, though, and I've already on this programme discussed, for example, the total flop, who was a neighbouring MP, to wit Lord Swire, and there are many others, failed MPs, ludicrous people who have been pushed forward in inflating the House of Lords to ever steadily greater numbers. I'm told that like many bad clubs, it's one it's even difficult to get a table at for lunch, so there we are. Is this new? Well, not particularly. After all, if you go back through British history, you will find many members pushed into the peerage who were, quite frankly, people who were less than exemplary. In some cases, they were the personal favourites of monarchs, probably in a sexual sense. One can think of Piers Gaveston under, pretty well literally, Edward II, or the Duke of Buckingham in the case of James I, and so on. There have been people also who have given party funds, etc., 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 and there have been failed MPs aplenty, or people pushed forward into the Lords, if that is the right term, in order to free up seats. And of course, this is not something about simply of antiquity. After all, Edward II was monarch, as you all know, of England from 1307 to 1327. It's not simply in those terms, one could see it more frequently. Harold Wilson's notorious Pink List, by which pink not in some sense of homosexuality, but in some sense that that was the colour of the writing paper on which his lover, mistress, secretary allegedly wrote down the list, was one that was notorious. Mr. Blair Satoni, I think he is, who is still obviously alive, so one must be careful what one says about him. But I suspect future historians will look with some interest at the nature of patronage under him. And I think the same thing can be fairly said of the chumocracy that was David Cameron's. In other words, the practice under which prime ministers have abused the system in order to reward is not new, and Boris Johnson might be perceived as doing so at hyperspeed because he was only prime minister for 3 years, or more particularly because his period of office ended in multiple scandals, but he isn't new. And indeed, one could say that in this, the House of Lords is but part and parcel of the more general British practice of a rather dubious honours list, and indeed the nature of patronage as a whole. One could say that, and then one needs to pause for a second. You could say, well, surely this is true of all patronage systems. Surely it's true of every way in which people get promoted, that being, as it were, the right man or woman, irrespective of their other merits, but simply because they are seen in that light, appears to be obvious. And I wrote the history of the University of Exeter. I am sure successive vice chancellors felt they were promoting people on their merit, but there were clearly other factors that played a role. And I think I made it fairly clear what some of those were in the history. And there's no reason to believe that the same is not true of other institutions. One doesn't have to be shocked with some kind of puritanical interest in virtue to be surprised that people who run things like to reward those who are their chums, and that the idea of a pure system of merit, whatever that means, is one for utopian fiction, i.e. political thought, rather than in the practice of politics. So I think one can say here that the question is rather not so much is something gone particularly badly wrong at the present moment, but is it the case, and we have had Conservative administrations, albeit one as a coalition that pushed in a whole lot of unworthy Liberal Democrats, but we have had Conservative administrations since 2010. Has it been the case that partly because of demography, people are just living too long, and COVID, despite all the fuss, didn't actually kill very many people. We just have too many members of the House of Lords. It's become ridiculous, but almost like a Gilbert and Sullivan act, because it is so much larger than the Commons. So many members of the House of Lords take generous daily allowances and only sit in the chamber for 5 minutes. If you don't believe it, I've seen it done. I was taken for lunch to the Lords. I've been taken many times. And my host on one occasion said, if you'll excuse me for a few minutes. And he sat in the chamber for 5 minutes and then proceeded to obviously claim his daily allowance. And let me tell you, that is true across the political spectrum. So clearly, there is a degree to which what we might regard as incompetent or corrupt practices have been going on for a long time, but have been pushed to the fore in recent years. Now, they have been pushed to the fore for reasons. I mean, one of the reasons, of course, was the needs of government since 2010. The Liberal Democrats, having come into power, or rather, let one say, a junior role in a coalition government, were intent on rewarding many of the mediocrities that had held office in minor capacities during their, as it were, Liberal Democrat life. The Conservatives, particularly in recent years, have been concerned to try and redress what they see as a non-conservative bias or emphasis in the House of Lords, and that became more consequential in terms of the latter stages of the Brexit legislation, etc., etc. The paradoxical thing is that the Conservatives, whom you might think, were you a Burkean, had some interest in constitutional continuity, that the Conservatives appear to have undermined a part or a pillar or an institution of the state. Anyway, that's one respect, and we'll come back to that in this discussion. Let us now look at the, as it were, Brown choice. Now, the Brown choice is a curious one, but in a way reflects his membership of the Tony Blair administration, which came to power in 1997, pledged to modernise Britain, and seeing constitutional, in their eyes, reform, we could call it change, as a way to do that. And that included, of course, a whole host of matters, including, for example, devolved governments in Scotland and Wales. It included changing the constitution of the House of Lords, getting rid of the hereditary peerage by right and reducing the number of the hereditary peers, etc., etc. It included an attempt rejected by that thing we're now all supposed to curse, but at the time nobody cursed, a referendum, the attempt to introduce regional government into England, to wit the northeast of England, which the worthy electors there, I used to live there, I could have told people it would have been turned down, rejected. Now, the Brown method is one which in a way reflects both, I suppose, a noble goal, which is trying to preserve the union, trying to keep at bay the rather disturbing populists. I mean, everybody talked about Brexiteers as populists, the worst populists, if you wish to use that term, in Britain, in terms of thinking as it's customarily used of people who, as it were, whip up emotion as a substitute for reason, are, of course, the SNP with their rather scabrous and dishonest separatism. But Brown's real basis in opposing that is in part to do, of course, with the interests of the Labour Party. The Labour Party can only confidently govern in Britain if it retains its position in Scotland as well as England and Wales. That was the basis under which Blair introduced the devolved assemblies, governments, under the legislation in 1997. As with much that Blair introduced, he of course was stupid in the sense that he assumed he could understand the outcomes when, of course, as we all know, the SNP swept to power within a few years. So this in a way is designed to, if you like, be stage two of that, and is designed to say, there may well be an SNP government in Edinburgh, there may be a Sinn Féin government eventually in Belfast, there may be eventually applied and Labour government in Cardiff, but they can all stay together in the United Kingdom by being part of an upper chamber. Well, you know, that's a view that has been held. There are several problems with it. I mean, it consists obviously of politicising to a greater degree the second chamber and therefore moving it into a different form of identity to that which it holds at the present moment when it's substantially constitutionally seen as a revising chamber. There is the question of how you would give a in a situation in which the English have over 80% of the vote, how you would satisfy the non-English representatives in such an upper chamber. Would they insist on a blocking or veto measure, which in my view would be foolish, because that in effect would be to disenfranchise the English in many respects. What would you do? How would you elect for these areas? So there's also linked to this another aspect of the New Labour strategy, which, as I pointed out, was rejected by the worthy inhabitants of the northeast of England and then abandoned by the Blair administration, that one of the arguments that's been made is that England should be split into regions and those regions should be in some way represented. Well, as you may, listeners may know, there is actually very little sense of commonality in what are seen as English regions. Some of them have enormous chips on their shoulder about other members. The Cornish hate being, as they see it in any respect, run from Exeter, let alone Bristol or Swindon, let alone London. So I don't quite, and what on earth is the East Midlands in political or constitutional terms? So I'm not sure that I see this as working terribly well. And I can also see it as having all sorts of unintended consequences. There is, in part, the question, if you had elections for an upper chamber, whether those elections would give it democratic validity and therefore an ability in some respects to thwart the lower chamber with all sorts of the problems of impasse that might exist as a result, and that impasse causing in some respects an inability to carry through change when the British state is so powerful that the idea that it just sits there and has no change whatsoever is one that one would not, I think, necessarily view with tremendous confidence. So there is that aspect. There is the question of proportional representation. Proportional representation was also rejected in a referendum by the British public. Again, that tends to be forgotten. So is this yet another attempt to push through what has been rejected? And of course, it has to be recalled that proportional representation, if it is going to operate in terms of a percentage seats with reference to the percentage of the votes, is likely to have consequences which do not match those of some of the people that support it. It was pushed most ardently by the Liberal Democrats in the early two teens, only in the 2015 election for UKIP to gain substantially more votes than the Liberal Democrats, and UKIP would have had about a sixth of the seats between 2015 and 2019 under the very Liberal Democrat scheme. Taking this further, I think it's reasonable to say that just as the Labour Party traditionally has contained the far left and the Conservatives have contained the far right, once you move to proportional representation, then there would be no reason for those bodies not to splinter and for once for us to have, as say France does, explicitly far left and far right parties with all the issues for stability that could arise. And we might also have sectarian parties as in Northern Ireland, but in this case, Islamic ones. So I think there are many problems that need to be addressed. What other possibilities could one think about? Because am I going back to more or less saying, let's be bland and complacent. We've always had problems. If it's a mess, well, it's always been a mess. Well, there are several things one could say. One could inquire as to whether we actually need a House of Lords. Do we, or would we be best served with a unicameral parliament, rather on the Portuguese model? And with that unicameral model, possibly having strengthened select committees in which the select committees had prescribed revising powers for relevant legislation, plus a reasonably sophisticated system of administrative support, and therefore a much more powerful sort of position in the administration and in the process of governance. That's a possibility, and it takes us right back to, as it were, the Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 89, because, as listeners will know, in the 1690s, the idea of the House of Commons sitting in this fashion pretty well all the time, or parts of it sitting pretty well all the time, was actually seriously discussed, envisaged, and for a while attempted in the 1690s. So it's not exactly as this would be a constitutional novelty. Or alternatively, do we tinker with the existing system? And if so, if we tinker, what problems might that cause. Now, there are some issues that you might think are relatively obvious to concern yourself with. First of all, it might be the case that there would be validity in having an age limit for people to be members of the House of Lords, possibly the same age limit as the judiciary, and possibly the same ought to be introduced in the House of Commons. People might say in the Commons that this infringes the rights of electors. It certainly doesn't in the House of Lords. Alternatively, you might say that people should be members for only 6 years or 10 years, you choose what you want, or you should say that your membership should lapse if you do not attend the House a certain number of times. All of those can be considered. It might be regarded separately as a total anachronism that we have a group of men and women selected simply because they are members of a religious group, and that they sit in the House of Lords. That might be regarded as bizarre. Why on earth should one have members of the Church of England there any more than any other religious group, including Druids or anything else that the census body chooses to ask people to register with? I think the penultimate census, I think about 120,000 people registered as Druids, but maybe I've mistaken that and my memory is poor at the moment. But anyway, that is itself an interesting point to consider. And one has to be very chary about the idea that one puts in representatives of so-called worthy bodies, because one ends up, if one's not careful, with a corporatist group of people who are essentially time servers, and not necessarily people who have any particular wisdom other than those of servicing a committee. So that is a point that, as it were, could be thought about. It is certainly the case that many members of the House of Lords at the present moment strike much of the public as having no particular merit. At least those in the House of Commons who might lack merit are accountable at general elections and, in theory, are to, as it were, answer their constituents' representations in between. And most of them try and do so, to varying extent, but nevertheless, they try to do so. There is no such position in the House of Lords. And indeed, many of the people there lack the ability or knowledge to be sound members of any revising chamber. There are some good ones constitutionally. People like Lord Norton or Lord Hennessy are able people whose views are well worth hearing on any matter of constitutional import. But it has to be said that these are a minority of that chamber. And indeed, with the expansion of the chamber, a growingly small minority. So the last point I would make is a simple one. I've already referred to Edmund Burke, and Edmund Burke, of course, is a lodestar in conservative theory. It has to be remembered when one puts Burke on a pedestal that actually Britain constitutionally has changed very frequently. And indeed, through the 19th and 20th century, it has changed in all sorts of respects, including Parliament Acts that have altered the role and power of the House of Lords, as well as obviously constitutional methods, measures such as joining the European Economic Community, or more recently, leaving the European Union, and so on. Also for monarchs, one can think of the Act of 2013, which altered the nature of the succession so that young women and young men are not in any way in a different status. So it is not the case that we should necessarily say that to reform the Lords or change the Lords would be a terrible thing, or that it would bring down the constitution, threaten the monarchy, or whatever else we might want to say. But rather, we should be cautious. We should think about the last period of profound constitutional change, and one could actually say two periods of profound constitutional change. The early years of the Blair administration, which certainly didn't have the consequences he intended, and which, if anything, escalated the tensions within the United Kingdom. One can think of the early years of the Cameron administration. In fact, the entire Cameron administration, a rather feckless fool of a prime minister, who pushed through all sorts of measures, allowing votes on things like proportional representation, Scottish independence, and Brexit, all of which could have worked out in ways that were unexpected, and the last of which, from his point of view, did. And one can then think of the constitutional strain of the last few years. Whether one likes or dislikes the outcome, it was certainly a period of constitutional strain. So the question that actually we end up with is this. Britain is in a mess at the moment. The British like fondly to imagine that you change your government, you ease the situation. You don't necessarily. And I think that the kind of mess we're in, living beyond our means, enormous fiscal hole, problems, serious problems in the union, serious problems with law and order, serious problems with productivity, education, health, pollution, etc. You fill in the list. They're not going to change necessarily if you change government. So the question then on the constitution is it sensible to add constitutional wrangles? Or alternatively, is it necessary to supercharge changes in the constitution in order possibly to make it easier to address these other issues? Or lastly, is debating the constitution a pleasing distraction from the actual really difficult problems that face us? Over to you, Graham. And I understand that you turned down your peerage. You must be the only person who did in the face of Mr. Johnson's blandishments.
Well, I turned it down before even being offered it. So that's the way it went. You can still just call me plain Mr. Stewart. But
Dr. Stewart, have the right title with honour. That's far more honourable than being some toady MP that's been pushed into the Lords.
Dr. Stewart, it shall be then. I want to start with just kind of reflecting on, I mean, there's so many different efforts and plans to reform the Lords, and most of them have come a cropper. Do you sense that the primary reason, other than inertia and party advantage, is the failure of reformers to really synchronize the two different aspects of reform, which is to say, to what extent should the powers of the second chamber be reformed away from its current role as a revising chamber to something more distinct in itself, but also the second line, which is the composition. You know, how are the members of the upper chamber either selected or elected? And the more you try and create a democratic legitimacy for a reformed upper chamber, the assumption is that the greater the powers it will have. But I've never seen properly articulated what level of power a reformed upper chamber would have, which was directly elected and had sufficient power for the average voter to bother to go out to vote in such an election.
Well, that's a fascinating point. By the way, you might, next time you use a phrase like to come a cropper, explain for the benefit of listeners in foreign countries what on earth we are talking about. They're going to think we're even more peculiar than most people think the British are. Anyway, yes, I think that is a very fair comment, not least the last one. If you think about it, only 72% of the population who could have voted voted in the 2016 referendum. And in most general elections, we're talking of percentages lower than that. I think that you're absolutely right. Why hasn't this been taken further? Well, in terms of the legislative program of government, it's a low priority on the whole, not least because the patronage of running the Lords, in the sense of putting in fresh members of the House of Lords, is very welcome to prime ministers and managerially important to public, to party funds, and also to as it were, managing members of the House of Commons. So those are important factors. Secondly, I think that it's reasonable to say that when there was the, as it were, opportunity for constitutional change in 2010, the coalition negotiations between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, what the Liberal Democrats really wanted was a proportional representation referendum. That was what really concerned them. There was also, of course, subsequently interest in the West Lothian question. The House of Lords wasn't really there. Under Tony Blair, of course, there was an attempt to change the House of Lords, and indeed the House of Lords was significantly changed in the altering of the hereditary peerage down to a small number who are produced by a vote within that body. But it has to be said, he then lost interest. So I think it's that partly governments have other things to do, and governments do control the legislative process. And secondly, the existing system, dubious as it is often in their interest. And as you correctly say, the government essentially represents a majority in the House of Commons. The idea that they should strain to endow legitimacy on another chamber, legitimacy in the sense of a ability to challenge their decisions by saying they have the other chamber has a direct democratic mandate, is not likely to recommend itself to a cabinet, which is almost always members of the House of Commons.
So why is someone like Gordon Brown so determinedly focused on a federation chamber? And I mean, you raise some of the issues, unless you federate England, in which case you create regions that most people don't have loyalty to, you're going to just recreate an imbalance in which England is 80%. So if it's a chamber of nations, England effectively has a veto on what the other nations of the UK might propose, which is just an even bigger recipe for trouble between the home nations. What am I missing with Gordon Brown's approach? How does it make sense to him in a way that someone like myself can't grasp?
Well, let me just say, I mean, Mr. Brown was responsible as Chancellor for a whole host of mistakes and from taxation of dividends, which helped to encourage investment in an inflated housing market, selling off the gold, inflating the public sector borrowing in the late 2000s, failing to, as it were, get the country into a sound fiscal situation to face what was really difficult circumstances in the late 2000s into the 2010s. So I don't think, you know, he likes to present himself as a sage, and because Tony Blair made himself unpopular over the Iraq War, and indeed was a glib and superficial figure, and because succeeding Labour leaders in the shape of Messrs Miliband and Corbyn were not exactly the leading lights of brilliance and leadership, it's not surprising that people have tended to overrate Brown. He was a mediocre machine politician. He's got a history doctorate, but I can tell you, I've met, and you've met, many people with history doctorates who are not the brightest and the best. And I think it's fair to say that he presents himself as the man to save the union. That's an example of the poverty, you're Scottish, of course, the poverty of Scottish politics at the moment, that he is seen as the great sage from north of the border. So I don't propose to discuss whether he has a brilliant idea that you fail to understand. I would call that a question mal pose. What I would say is it's one that is advanced without thinking through many of the dire problems that might face it?
Well, I wonder if we can turn to some of the problems of the existing House of Lords rather than the various plans and fantasies of what might reform or replace it. And I mean, there is pretty broad consensus that the current House of Lords is too large. As you've said, the rate of peerage creation is greater than the rate in which peers are dying. It's one of the largest legislative chambers in the world. Has the time come for what would actually be a relatively simple reform, which is for the life peers to follow the example of the hereditary peers? As you mentioned, the hereditary peers now elect their own number from amongst themselves. Isn't it perhaps time for the life peers to have a similar form of election so that their numbers are drastically reduced to a manageable size of chamber?
Well, I certainly think we can discuss what is best. Personally, I think you need an age limit. I think that you need a limit in terms of commitment. Many members of the House of Lords are very, very, very occasionally at best there. So I think those are the two things I would look for most. Hopefully that itself would winnow down the numbers considerably. I think there are all sorts of problems if you politicise the upper chamber completely. And I think that an electoral process might well do that. I also have to say, I'm sorry if it irritates people, and I am, of course, a Conservative, and I hate coming along with radical ideas, but I actually think it's time to scrap the hereditary peerage's role in the House of Lords and also that of the bishops. I think these are, historical legacies which have very little relevance at the present moment. But I'm not precisely committed to the idea that a bicameral system is working in Britain, and I'm not sure how best to proceed in that context. I certainly would like to see stronger House of Commons select committees. I think that's very important. I think if you've got strong House of Commons select committees, I'm not quite sure that you need House of Lords select committees also reviewing things. But if you're going to have the House of Lords, that's its major role in terms of House of Lords select committees. Now, clearly, if that is the case, you need people of energy, determination, and ability. And I would have thought, there are people, we all know people in their late 80s who are people of enormous energy, intellect, etc., etc. But it is less common as you get older. I am sure there are people who only appear twice a year and nevertheless make an important contribution, but actually I'm just fibbing there. I don't think there are. So I think it's fairly clear in my mind that age, commitment and attendance ought to be crucial criteria.
Well, let's end by imagining a future in which it's no longer the Houses of Parliament, it's the House of Parliament. And it's a unicameral chamber. The revising role is effectively undertaken by select committees of the House of Commons, which is the sole chamber. In such a world, what would we being the British people, what would we lose by no longer having a House of Lords?
Well, that's for listeners to make their own assessment of. I can't say what other people would lose. I'm not sure that I would necessarily see the House of Lords as playing a key role in providing competent, effective government. And I'm not sure I would see it as part of a democratic and accountable system. And, I was described on the BBC, and I thought this was hilarious, when I was one of the witnesses on the Moral Maze. I was described by the chairman as an extreme democrat. I think it's only in Britain can somebody who believes in democratic accountability be called an extreme democrat. I can't quite see where the democratic accountability is in the upper chamber. And, there are problems, for example, in upper chambers in other countries. I personally do not think that the American system, which of course is an America is a federal state rather than a democracy, but I don't see that the American system, where Wyoming has the same number of senators as Texas, as a brilliant answer. But at least the senators in America, as we've just been seeing, are democratically accountable. So actually, I have to tell you, I'm not, you know, I'm off, you know, I prefer to think good things about my country. And individual members of the House of Lords, some of whom I know, are, I'm sure, people of probity and integrity, and some of them of industry in their particular job or particular calling. And many of them, I'm sure, deserve whatever you praise. But I do not think that they, as it were, should be a long service upper house going on, as it were, as the crust forms, and with virtually no, that I can see, accountability whatsoever.
Well, one of the joys of this conversation is that we could have had it at almost any time over the last 100 years, and many of the issues we've been wrestling with, we would have been as alive then as they are now. But we must call it a day there. Professor Jeremy Black, for talking us through the House of Lords. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that's interesting, because you remind me in that suggestion that I could almost be, though it's more than 100 years ago, of course, a sort of Lloyd George. I would never have liked to see myself in that role. But I think, you know, I think we're both conservatives. I think it's worth considering the extent to which the Conservative Party has often tried to represent notions of reform and change, and that the idea that conservatives simply say what we had in the past is great and we have to keep it going is wrong. What I think we should stand for is, in this particular respect, there are many other things we stand for, is to say that we're aware that change can have serious and detrimental consequences, and we need to consider it carefully. So I've lived through what I thought were, on the whole, sensible change under the administration of Mrs. Thatcher, and foolish change under those of Tony Blair and David Cameron. Obviously, many other, I mean, I've been around for a long time, many other administrations. I don't think that change is necessarily either good or bad. But in the case of the House of Lords, I really cannot see that there is much of value to be gained from the present system.
Well, we must leave it there. Professor Black, thank you again.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.